The topic for review this week is the second of the four Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings, Karuna, which is translated as compassion. The practice of compassion is integral to Buddhism as well as other faith traditions. This is reflected just something as basic as the Four Noble Truths. Understanding the experience of dukkha, of distress and confusion. Understanding the craving and clinging is what causes dukkha. And liberation from dukkha is attainable, and that's where the compassion shows up, so to speak. And this is enabled through the principles and practices of the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, I've been using a different translation for dukkha. Dukkha is usually translated as suffering, which is certainly valid. But to me, it's more workable when we use the terms distress and confusion. Distress addresses the emotional element of dukkha. And distress can either be unpleasant stress or the stress that comes from desire. And confusion points to the inability of the human mind to actually create an absolutely valid and always workable understanding of how to be in the world. And the nature of the mind is miraculous, but it can never provide an entirely reliable or even useful rendering of how the world is. We might find something that is a good enough fit for the circumstances to actually be beneficial, but it is impermanent and does not emerge from an enduring self. It's all interdependent. Now, the cultivation of compassion builds from something that's innate in the human experience, empathy. I mentioned this in the guided meditation that preceded this talk tonight, in which will be posted on the website. You can find it in the archives. Compassion contemplation, guided compassion contemplation. But we are vibing off each other all the time. And the way we understand our own dukkha is through our relationships with others. This begins from, you know, infancy. A child has an experience, does not understand what it is. There's certainly distress involved. But there's confusion about what is this? What can be done about it? So that's the job of the caregiver, the parent, to show up when there's pain and bring relief when possible. And most often it's possible. Something as, you know, basic as changing a diaper or feeding a hungry baby. Somehow or other, those actions, they're expressions of compassion, but they also help developing personality to understand what's going on. And then by projection, we can infer what someone else's experience might be. Now, I've talked about this before. We're hardwired for empathy. There are parts of the brain that are involved in mimicry. When we observe someone else's behavior, part of the brain creates a pattern, a neurological pattern, so that we can repeat that behavior. It might have to do with, you know, understanding how to pronounce a certain word, or to tie your shoes, or anything like that. When you think about it, teaching a child to tie her shoes, that's an act of compassion. Helps the child fit in socially, but also protect her feet. This becomes even more fully developed as children become immersed in language. We can put words to what the body is experiencing. Understand it. There's a feeling in your stomach, and the parent says, oh, you're hungry. So then you might connect hunger with that physical sensation. So, as I said a moment ago, we are inherently empathic. We vibe off each other. And that's where compassion plays out. Now, compassion is a derivative of loving kindness. Loving kindness basically blends right intention with right understanding as part of the Four Noble Eightfold Path. We can have an experience that is not harsh, not hurtful, but is benevolent, uplifting, productive, so forth and so on. So this is the lays the groundwork. Loving kindness lays the groundwork for the work of the empathic attunement that represented by compassion, and also by another one of the four divine abidings, sympathetic joy, mudita, which will be discussed next week. So, this experience of compassion basically is a manifestation of action that emerges from loving kindness, but also from insight. During the guided contemplation tonight, I talked about how important mindfulness is. I'll be talking more about that later on this evening, but being mindful and being aware of what's being formed in the mind, which is called investigation of mental phenomena, that kind of present moment analytical awareness helps us understand what's happening. And that is part of what's called right understanding in the Noble Eightfold Path. But that has to be combined with right intention, which is loving kindness, benevolent intention. And that involves managing the flow of energy or effort, which in the Noble Eightfold Path is called right effort. So we have three functions or factors. They're actually the first three of the seven awakening factors: mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, and energy as it's expressed through right effort. And right effort basically is combined with mindfulness and investigation in turning away from self-state organizations that are unwholesome, that are harsh or cruel toward oneself or toward others, and fosters the development of self-state organizations that are benevolent, that are kind and generous, thoughtful, compassionate. So when we cultivate compassion, those three functions are an integral part of that. And once again, that's reflected in the guided meditation. It was I fostered earlier this evening. Now, when we talk about the four divine abidings, we also have to mention what's called the far enemy and the near enemy. The far enemy of any one of those four is the antithesis, the opposite. The near enemy is a misunderstanding, a misrepresentation of that particular divine abiding. It seems superficially to be a manifestation of that, but it isn't really. It does not really bring relief from distress and confusion. The far enemy of compassion is harshness and cruelty. Now, harshness is a manifestation of nature. Being ill is harsh. Being cold is harsh. Being involved in some sort of natural disaster is harsh. So many hundreds of thousands of people right now are being adversely impacted by the series of storms that are sweeping across the United States, even as I'm speaking. That's nature. Now, storms happen, snowstorms happen, blizzards happen, but they're happening more frequently and are more devastating now because there's simply more people in the U.S., more people on the highways, more people using the energy of electricity and gas and so forth, but also because we've been not been compassionate regarding the environment. So that brings us to cruelty. Cruelty is something that occurs because of human influence. It is aversion and ill will in action. When people operate out of hate or fear and hurt each other, steal from each other, so forth and so on. That's cruelty. So that's the far enemy of compassion. When we know someone is ill, compassion wants to bring some relief to that. Or if someone's hungry, feed them. And if there's cruelty, you do what you can to intervene. As I'm saying this, I'm remembering something that Matt Flickstein, one of my teachers, said. He was riding through New York City with his teacher, and he saw a homeless person on the street. Or they saw, and the teacher said, what would be the compassionate action regarding that person? And Matt said, oh, to feed him, of course. And the master told him, well, feeding him is right, but it would be far better to share a meal with that homeless person. The near enemy of compassion is pity. I mentioned this after I just told this little story, Matt Flickstein told us. You could regard a homeless person as being pitiful. Pity is a word that's pretty common in the English language. It has a different connotation in this context. One of the things I mentioned in the guided meditation was the impact of distress and confusion when someone is conflicted through dukkha. There's the feeling of separation, of isolation, of being alone. And when you pity someone, there's a separation there. There's an embedded assumption that that person is less than. Somehow or other, they have a lower status. One of the things that's unfortunate about elements of our culture, not the elements that are truly spiritual, but others, say that when someone is homeless, it's their own fault. Because they're lazy, or they're stupid, or they just simply have bad luck. And bad luck, of course, is, you know, disparaging of a person. Well, there are so many hundreds of thousands of people now with the pandemic and these terrible storms who are homeless and hungry, right? They're not pitiful. As I mentioned earlier in the talk, we understand the pain of another through our own experience. This is something that I was part of the guided meditation as well. Just as I have been hurt, so have you. May you be, you know, relieved of your hurt. So that's why pity is not a good term to understand what's going on that requires compassion. It's the near enemy because it creates a sense of separation. So how do we come to terms with the far enemy and the near enemy? Well, I mentioned it a few minutes ago. I want to mention it again because it's that important. Mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, and right effort. You notice when your mind is... there's a term, it's a $10 word called Schadenfreude. Maybe some of you have heard of it. Schadenfreude basically is translated as meaning taking delight in someone else's misfortune, downfall, misery. You can notice when your mind is starting to entertain that. It serves them right. They got what's coming to them. You know, to be aware of that and to use right effort to disengage the flow of attention away from that sort of internal narrative and instead realize there's another human being there who's distressed and confused. One of my basic operating principles is that when someone else misbehaves, they're caught up in dukkha, distress and confusion. I was recently rereading an excellent book by Sharon Salzberg called Loving Kindness, Revolutionary Art of Happiness. And in that book, she recalled a time when she was in Russia leading a retreat. And when she was leaving the country, she had to go through customs. And the officer who took her passport gave her these really nasty looks. Really harsh and accusatory and disdainful, and it frightened her. But then she realized, wow, you know what? This person has to go home and live in that. And that changed her fear into compassion. There's a lot of suffering there. And that's one of the things I suggest to people when they're confronted with someone else who's hostile. First of all, take care of yourself. You know, don't let yourself get beat up or whatever way you can. But respond with compassion. You're witnessing suffering. This other person's hurtful behavior is because of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And they're suffering because of that. They may not think they are. They may think that they're winning. But they're not. They're suffering. And our response can be shaped by the intention to be compassionate rather than the intention to get even. Now, how do we cultivate compassion? Well, another thing that I described was every time you practice mindfulness of breathing, that in and of itself, I described this during the guided meditation. Every time you notice your attention is wandered away from the breath and you brought it back to focusing on breath sensation, that's an act of compassion. Every time you sit down to meditate, you are cultivating compassion. Because the goal of meditation practice is alleviating dukkha, bringing relief from distress and confusion. That's why we do it. It creates more stability in the mind in terms of our attention. And because the sensation of breathing is not afflicted with craving and clinging, you have to actively, intentionally decide to investigate the breath. Because of that intention and the action that you take, there's no craving there. Or if there is some kind of urgency in your physiology, it tends to decrease because, you know, the energy of craving is not being introduced into your bloodstream, so to speak. That's compassion in action. As we become more and more aware of how the mind is operating and more clear about liberating the mind from distress and confusion, we know how to do it. There's a progression of liberation that occurs. The first one is from the most crude kinds of craving and clinging that are associated with reactivity, impulsive reactivity that's not, you don't bring mindfulness and investigation to it, you just react. This happens every time the mind gets lost in a story. When you can train the mind to be alert to the instigation of that kind of process and intervene and go back to the breath, that's a really good thing to do. Because the end result of that, not the end result, a result of that, a conditioned that develops from that is called samadhi-paccati. A samadhi is unification of mental factors. It's usually translated as concentration. But what it really means in this context is the wholesome functions of how the mind operates are unified, coordinated, mutually supportive. That's what samadhi is. Paccati is tranquility. Because the mind is not being disturbed and agitated by craving and clinging, there's a calmness, peacefulness. It's not dull, it's not sluggish, it's very alert, very effective, but also very serene. So that develops further. Cultivation of samadhi-paccati is kind of the optimal level of the way the mind functions for developing insight, vipassana. And what we're trying to understand with that is the transient, impermanent nature of our subjective experience. It's changing all the time. Moment by moment is changing. The other part of it is insight into the conditioned nature of the mind, how the mind creates a self. And this creative process is constantly changing. And as it changes, it's either falling into a slot of unwholesomeness or a slot of wholesomeness. You become more and more sophisticated, more and more subtle in noticing the transitory nature of subjective awareness, and less vulnerable to making a self out of what the mind creates. This doesn't mean that you can't function. In fact, you function much more effectively. But that's the next level of benefit that comes from compassion. And of course, you operate from that level in your relationship with others. So you tend to become more patient with others, more inclined to be helpful, less reactive, less impulsive. And moving through that level of compassion finally move to the level of true liberation. When this happens, is what happens when a person experiences nirvana, the unconditioned, which can happen. I used to think when I first started doing this that that was, you know, once in a million years someone would experience nirvana. No, there are probably tens of thousands of people right now walking around on the planet who have directly experienced nirvana and who may be pretty much awakened. So it's possible. It can be done. In fact, the Buddha said, if I didn't think it could be done, I wouldn't be telling you it can be done. I wouldn't do that. It would not be compassionate. Now, once someone becomes awakened, their ability to be compassionate is amplified significantly. They still have that empathic attunement because they know the nature of dukkha. They know the nature of craving and clinging. But because the function of the mind is not confused and the emotions are not aroused, the ability to say and do things that are beneficial, that are shaped through compassion and skillful means, becomes more and more to the forefront in their decisions and their actions. Now, I want to talk a little bit about some of the research that's been done, scholarly research, you know I love to do this, about compassion. This first is a quote, a couple of quotes, from an article in the Buddhist Publication Society entitled Detachment and Compassion in Early Buddhism by a woman named Elizabeth Harris. At least three strands of meaning in the term compassion can be detected in the texts. A prerequisite for a just and harmonious society, an essential attitude for progress along the path toward wisdom, and the liberative action within society of those who have become enlightened or who are sincerely following the path towards it. All these strands need to be looked at if the term is to be understood, and if those who accuse Buddhist compassion of being too passive are to be answered correctly. Further on in the article, the Buddha's teachings about statecraft and government also embody compassion as a guiding principle. Chakyavada Sihananda Sutta describes a state in which the king ignores his religious advisors and does not give wealth to the poor. Poverty becomes widespread, and in its wake follow theft, murder, immorality in various forms, and communal breakdown. The culmination is a sword period, in which men and women look upon one another as animals and cut one another with swords. In this sutta, lack of compassion for the poor leads to the disintegration of society. Lack of social and economic justice leads to disaster. In contrast, the ideal Buddhist model for society, as deduced from the texts, would be one in which exploitation in any part of its structure is not cruel. Isn't that interesting? This sutta was passed on for generations thousands of years ago. Think about what goes on in our society these days. In the book Altered Traits, Daniel Goleman and David Richardson, Richie Davidson, sorry, I wrote Richardson down here, Richie Davidson, comment on the practice of karuna. Compassion meditation shows stronger benefits from the get-go. As few as 7 total hours over the course of 2 weeks leads to increased connectivity in circuits important for empathy and positive feelings, strong enough to show up outside the meditation state per se. This is the first sign of a state morphing into a trait, though these effects likely will not last without daily practice. But the fact that they appear outside the formal meditation state itself may reflect our innate wiring for basic goodness. Loving kindness and compassion practice over the long term enhances neural resonance with another person's suffering, along with concern and a greater likelihood of actually helping. Attention, too, strengthens in many aspects with long-term practice. Selective attention sharpens. The attentional blink diminishes. Sustained attention becomes easier and an alert readiness to respond increases. And long-term practitioners show enhanced ability to down-regulate the mind-wandering and self-obsessed thoughts of the default mode, as well as weakening connectivity within those circuits, signifying less self-preoccupation. These improvements often show up during meditative states and generally become traits. Well, that's the quote. Let me elaborate. Attentional blink. This phenomenon occurs when two different visual or auditory stimuli are presented with a gap of a fraction of a second. The second stimulus is ignored. The default mode network is the normal process of the relaxed, non-goal-oriented functioning of the brain, involving daydreaming, planning, etc. Research suggests that the default mode network is weakened in the brain functioning of highly trained meditators. That is, they are less prone to absent-mindedness and self-absorption. Now, what's mentioned in the book that I did not quote was there was a lama who had been a neuroscientist, a biologist, I think, PhD biologist, Frenchman. And he had been a lama for many years, and they wanted to do research on what's called preorbital dominance. They knew that someone who was distressed and confused, the right side of their forehead was highly activated. It's called right preorbital dominance. When a person is not in a bad way, in other words, their functioning is wholesome, they exhibit left preorbital dominance. Well, they hooked this llama up to the equipment, functional MRI equipment, and he started practicing Tibetan Buddhist contemplation called Tonglen, which I'll be talking about more extensively in a few minutes. They were astonished. His ability to develop and sustain left preorbital dominance was utterly remarkable. At that point, they had never had anybody be able to do that intentionally for as long as he could do it. And they were astonished. They said, oh, wow, that's actually extraordinary. And he laughed and he said, there are people who have been doing this in the mountains, in the Himalayas, for far longer than I have. And I'm sure that they're much more adept at it than I am. So you can train for this. And this is, I think, what they're referring to when in the Altered Traits book. By the way, a state is something that is circumstantially developed. A trait is something that a person can do voluntarily for extended periods of time. So what they were describing with this lama was a trait. All right, so one of the things that I mentioned in the guided meditation was how important it is to recognize the limits of what you can do with your compassionate practice. It might be that you're confronted with someone who you cannot fix the situation for them, but you can be a benevolent presence for them. I talked about the sense of isolation and separation that you can overcome with your attention. So when I'm saying this, what comes to mind is my relationship with my mother. My parents divorced when I was a teenager, and I had some conflicts with both of them over the decades afterwards. My mother got cancer, and when we got that diagnosis, they told her that it's nothing could be done about it, so we put her into hospice, and she came to live with us. Now, I had this sense of isolation and separation from my mother, because when I could be with her during the decades before, she was a very depressed person. And I would be in the room with her for a very brief period of time, and I would feel so heavy, so down and dreary, because I was vibing off of her depression. She was quite depressed. And I tried to get her help. I'm a mental health professional. Tried to get help for her. She wouldn't hear of it. I couldn't do anything about it. So I didn't spend a lot of time with my mom. Then she came to live with us for the last few months of her life, and she and I reconnected. And all I could do was to, you know, ease her pain and keep her company, and my wife too. That was really interesting, the empathic attunement that I experienced with my mother during that last interval of her life. So that really means a lot to me in terms of, you can cultivate compassion with someone, even though you can't do anything for them. You can, through your training, you can manifest a facial expression, tone of voice, body language that conveys kindness, patience, interest, generosity even, that can have some benefit for that other person. I know it did for my mom. Before she went into a coma, she and I was taking for a walk, and she was in a wheelchair. And she made this comment. She said, "Well, you know, you really are a good guy." Whoa, really? Surprised me. I didn't know she didn't think I was a good guy. But that's the way my mom was. She was not very forthcoming with what she was thinking and how she was feeling. But that was an interesting exchange. Now, I mentioned the Tibetan track practice called Tonglen. And I've actually done a series of talks on that several years ago. Tonglen is translated as receiving and sending. And the classic way it's developed is first the practitioner must must cultivate what's called relative bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is translated as awakened mind. Relative bodhicitta basically is cultivation of samadhi paccity. Then there's ultimate bodhicitta, which is nirvana. So relative bodhicitta basically means that you want to cultivate a quality of attention that is minimally intruded upon or disturbed by distress and confusion. And that's the experience of samadhi paccity. You train for that effect. The mind is calm and clear. Then something happens. Some thought occurs, or you become aware of someone who is distressed and confused. Might be your own distress and confusion that pops up in your mind. Because the mind is stable and relatively unburdened with distress and confusion, you can see it more quickly with more dispassion. Dispassion means less identification, less urgency. As a formation in the mind. And then you transform it into benevolent intention. So, the Tonglen practice, you cultivate relative bodhicitta, you take in or witness the suffering in the world, then you transform it through your own relative bodhicitta into benevolent intention that you radiate back out into the world. And you take action on that. Right? That's what Tonglen practice is. And I was using that as a guideline for the guided meditation in a very contracted form. 45-minute meditation, you can't really cover all the territory. But some of the topical areas that I touched on, first of all, cultivating samadhi paccity in the meditation, then cultivating loving kindness, but a short form. May I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be free from distress and confusion. And then transforming that into, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be free from distress and confusion. And radiating that out into the world, perhaps with certain people in mind. Then offering some different suggestions for contemplation. Just as I have been hurt, so have you. May we both be free from pain. Just as I have experienced loss, so have you. May we both recover from loss. Just as I have experienced rejection, so have you. May we both experience loving acceptance. Just as I have experienced illness, so have you. May we both regain health. So you can fill in whatever seems appropriate for that person. Disappointment, frustration, victim of aggression, homelessness, so forth and so on. Now, it might be that you have not experienced homelessness, but you can certainly imagine what it would feel like to not have a roof over your head. That would be part of the contemplation. Now, when you practice this formally in a meditation, you might pick just one of those phrases and repeat it for the whole sitting, focusing on someone you know. It might be someone you know very well. It might be somebody that you saw on the media. Now, you know, in the Christian world, they talk about praying for someone. I don't believe that somehow or other your prayer travels through the atmosphere and somehow or other makes things better for that person. What I think it does is it transforms how your mind interprets the experience emotionally and cognitively, and therefore behaviorally. So it transforms your own interactions with others, informed by empathy. So that's what you want to do with this practice. As you do that, meditation, this is something that was alluded to in that book, Altered Traits. One of the things that happens with dedicated meditative practice is it changes the structure of the neural networks in your brain in ways that are beneficial. So that when you practice generating compassion towards yourself or toward others privately while you're contemplating, your ability to remember to do that, for it to occur to you to do that when you're out in the world, is increased. Just like, you know, if someone wants to really be good at playing basketball, and you know that your weak shot is a hook shot, you don't wait until you're in a game or even a scrimmage to practice the hook shot. You practice it on the empty court, from all the different parts of the court. You do it over and over and over again. You're changing the neural networks in your brain and in your arms and legs and so forth and so on, so that when you are under pressure, you can actually, your body can actually do what you want it to do. Well, the same thing is true with meditative training, in this context with compassion. The more you practice cultivating compassion formally in the meditation, the more you are likely to be able to remember that the opportunity presents itself for you to do it when you're out in the world. That's a very important thing to realize. And I hope that encourages and inspires us all to our meditation practice. So, that's my presentation for the evening. We have time now for questions and comments. Any thoughts, any questions? And this might be also something that occurred to you during the meditation practice that I could clarify or help you with. Anybody? Yes, Sharon.
I just wanted to share, right before you went into the Dharma talk, my tea was steeping, and I looked down at the little tag on the yogi tea, and it says, "Let your heart speak to others' hearts." So, I think it's interesting, because that's, in essence, what compassion is. I think our hearts are speaking to other hearts, too.
Yes, absolutely. Other questions or comments? John?
I think that that's one of the basic functions of sitting consistently, is that you learn what your mind does and what your heart does. You can distinguish that. And I think just that habit is a pretty good balance that you got to kind of maintain, because you can forget to do it. I always appreciate that immensely. So.
Yep. And remember what I said, every time that you divert your attention away from a distraction and go back to the breath, that is compassion in action, right there.
Back to breath is
compassion.
That's good. That's
because, you know, what pulls us away has a great potential to elaborate into craving and clinging. I mean, if you just notice a sound in the room and you acknowledge it for what it is, and then you go back to the breath, that's not dukkha. But when that sound creates a story and your mind gets hooked into the story, that's dukkha. That's distress and confusion. But when you notice that with mindfulness and investigation, and you put into play right effort and you redirect the energy of your attention back to the breath, that's compassion.
It's also changing from mental gear to body gear in terms of feelings by going back to breath. You know what I mean? You're not stymieing the thought, but you're slowing it down to distinguish. And that is just something that this guy figured out 2,500 years ago, and it drives me crazy. He can't beat it.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, part of the practice involves focusing your attention on your heart, which is once again in your body. And as I was talking about last week, and I think the week before that, the vagus nerve, which connects from your brain to your heart and to your gut. When you really focus on that and you cultivate a benevolent intention, that creates what's called a beneficial vagal tone, which is good for your health, but also I think is an essential element of the practice of compassion. Other questions or comments before we have the closing meditation tonight? All right, let's sit for a moment. The topic for next week will be mudita, sympathetic joy, which is also an empathetic attunement to others, but it involves celebrating another's happiness, success. So let's sit for a moment. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well, and I hope that we are all safe and reasonably happy until the next time we have a chance to talk.